Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome to the Transfer Window, the podcast which brings you the news before it becomes news, as well as the best insight and analysis on all the topics you're talking about in the game. I'm Ian McGarry, and with me as always is Duncan Castles. And on today's pod, we will be giving you all of the analysis and also the fallout from, of course, Sunday's big Premier League match between Manchester United and Liverpool, followed by, of course, Valerie, our old friend, causing controversy and provoking one ex-Premier League referee to call it an absolute embarrassment to the Premier League itself. Heroes and villains will cap us off for today, but Duncan, as always, we start with some news. Last week, we brought you the breaking news that Manchester United were indeed attempting to lure in a potential buyer for all of the Glazer family's shares. I think the phrase we used was, you can't catch a fish without bait. And of course, that bait was Kevin Glazer converting B shares into A shares and under SEC rules on the New York Stock Exchange. But Duncan, it's elevated a little bit since then. And you've got news of a potential meeting between said family and the primary person we expect to bid for the club in Saudi Arabia.
Yes, this is news that the Manchester United will be sending a delegation to Saudi Arabia next month to attend the future investment initiative conferences that the Saudi Arabian government, Saudi Arabian royal family, under the auspices of a public investment fund of Saudi Arabia, host on an annual basis. This is something that the Glazers have attended in the past. They have strong relationships in the country. The interest in Saudi Arabia in Manchester United is long-standing. We talked about this in the podcast last year. Essentially, Saudi Arabia has seen what Qatar have done with Paris Saint-Germain and what Abu Dhabi, their regional allies, have done with Manchester City, and are keen to follow a similar strategy in the sense of buy a football club, use it as a marketing tool for the country, have your the country's name associated with that team's performances in European football, as has become the case with Manchester City and Paris Saint-Germain, and use it also for political purposes, the leverage that having control of a significant chunk of the world's most popular game can afford you. And remember, Saudi Arabia isn't simply interested in getting hold of a football club in the European game. It also has involvement with FIFA president Gianni Infantino and has been offering funding to FIFA, funding that could be very important to Infantino in terms of securing his presidency and control of FIFA going forward for an expanded Club World Cup. Again, parallels what Abu Dhabi and Qatar have done in terms of having an extensive reach across sport. Talking to people in the city, they reiterate that the interest from Saudi Arabia is long-standing. There have been suggestions that they may come back and put a formal offer in for the club, which currently is valued on the US, one of the US stock markets, at about $2.6 billion in the coming months. However, as far as they know, no further bid has been made at this stage. Remember, the valuation has declined significantly across the last year, I think by over 30% in terms of share price. But share price is essentially just an indicator, as we discussed in the podcast. If it gets to the point where a buyer with the finances that Saudi Arabia have is ready to make a proper offer for the Glazers' control of the club, then the Glazers will essentially be able to demand a price far higher or in excess of that stock market price, because they control the vote-owning shares, those B-class shares that you mentioned, that just one of the six siblings has chosen to convert to the lower voting rights A-class shares. And they can then decide for themselves whether they want to sell or not at that moment. Obviously, there can be external influence upon this. We see the Glazers out movement. Again, chartering a plane to fly above Old Trafford and remind Ed Woodward and the Glazers of their discontent with the way the club is being run. This time the banner read, "Ed still failing, Woodward out," before the match and just after kickoff. That group has been putting pressure on Manchester United sponsors in an environment in which commercial revenue has stalled at Manchester United, and they expect the club's income to fall next season. So those things can also have an impact, but I think fundamentally this comes down to a decision from the Glazer family as to whether any offer they get for the club is enough profit for them to get rid of what is kind of must be an irritation for them in terms of the response to their handling of the club. But remember, is also a significant source of annual revenue for them, with that, the gold pot that is going to arrive at a certain point should they decide to sell to a bidder such as Saudi Arabia.
Given the, I think it's fair to say, consistent criticism and protest has been against the Glazers' ownership of the club, Duncan, over the 13 years or so that they have been in charge. This now feels like it's a case of when and not if they will sell. And the amount of information that we're getting from people in the city, from sources close to Manchester United and the Glazers, appears to be that they are now actively seeking a buyer for the club, rather than when they've been approached, which they have been in the past on at least three occasions, have rejected offers outright. Now, when you're dealing with people who have money, the problem always is that if you don't need it, then why would you sell for a lesser stake than you could get sometime in the future? But again, with the projection that revenues will decline next season, as we mentioned in the last 10 days, the Chevrolet deal will not be renewed, etc., etc. The team are continually underperforming, and therefore the prestige value of Manchester United has been affected in terms of not winning trophies, and in fact not even appearing in the Champions League, which is a big source of revenue as well, and guaranteed revenue. As I said, it does seem to me to be we're entering into a period of inevitability. Now, I know that'll be music to the ears of a lot of Manchester United fans, and we can't guarantee it, but it does feel different this time, Duncan.
Look, there's certainly noises in that direction, but I think it's dangerous to make assumptions with the Glazers. The one thing we know about that family is they're very stubborn in terms of charting their own course when it comes to the ownership of major sporting operations. They own the MFL franchise, Tampa Bay Buccaneers, which has been, I think any American football expert will tell you, spectacularly unsuccessful in recent years, but has increased significantly in value and has been profitable for the Glazers. And they have retained ownership through that period. They've been through a period in the past, the green and gold movement, challenges from Manchester United supporters to their ownership, and they rode through that storm and have only seen the value of the asset they secured with the assistance, has to be said, of the current executive vice chairman, Ed Woodward, increase since then. So I think it's dangerous to assume that pressure on them will be a force that forces them to sell up. I think they will do it when it suits their interests and when the money is right for them. So you do need that big offer to come in from somewhere that they say, well, actually, this is such a large offer for the football club. It makes sense to take significant profit now and give up on the regular dividends and director's fees we take from the club. On the other side of this equation, of course, is it is an incredible asset, Manchester United. It's operating profits, base operating profits, when you strip out the costs of servicing the still very substantial debt that's left on Manchester United books because of the way the club was bought by the Glazers in a leveraged buyout, is bigger than any other club in world football. So you have that immense capacity to generate revenue, even with the problems they have with the team, with the squad, with the management structure, with the scouting operation that they've been boasting about so much recently. Despite the fact from top to bottom there are issues in the club, from a financial perspective, it's a hugely attractive prospect, because if you come in and you have the money to remove that debt burden and reorganise the team, reorganise the management structure, you have very large annual revenues that you can put into the team each year to solve those problems and get them back to a level which they should be at, which is competing for the Premier League, realistically competing for the Premier League each season and realistically competing for the Champions League.
We will, of course, not just be bringing the news first, but keeping you across all developments regarding Manchester United and potential takeovers, as well as, of course, the Glazers' position on that, and indeed that future investment meeting which happens in Saudi Arabia in November. A little bit more transfer news for you today, and that is that, as we know, Manchester United are desperately in need of a point striker. They are prepared to invest in January in that. We brought you the shortlist on the transfer window, but interestingly, an escalation in their interest in Timo Werner, the RB Leipzig striker, has occurred in the last 2 days in that we understand that United have now been in touch, not just with Werner's representatives, but also with RB Leipzig, his club, regarding a fee and what it would take to get him out of German's Bundesliga and to Old Trafford in January. That's something which would be obviously a huge advantage and a big boon for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer regarding the second half of the season. Duncan, we talked about obviously two Dembélés, Moussa and Ousmane. We discounted Ousmane in terms of injuries. Moussa, we believe that it, obviously Lyon are a difficult club to negotiate with, especially in January. What do you think of Werner and his chances, or indeed of United's chances of getting Werner in January?
I think it's obviously a credible option for them. I think the difficulty there is to persuade Werner that Manchester United is the right club to come to. I mean, we know Werner is a player who's been admired by Bayern Munich for a long time. If Bayern Munich make the calculation that Werner is a player they want for next season, then obviously they could come into that equation and say to Werner, don't go to Manchester United, we will be signing you in the summer, so choose us instead. And remember, Bayern Munich in the past season made a couple of very significant purchases well ahead of the summer transfer window, spending club record sums on defensive acquisitions who they knew they wanted for this summer. So recent Bayern Munich activity has been such that if they get into a situation where they feel they need to secure a player that they've identified as being the right man for them and doing a deal early on, they haven't been shy about getting themselves into that situation. So I think that's the complicated part for Manchester United if they decide that Werner is the one they prefer over Moussa Dembélé. And Moussa Dembélé for sure is interested in joining Manchester United. It is a club appeals to him. Playing in the Premier League is a very live option for him. It's something that he's targeted in his career. So in terms of the club to individual deal, in Dembele's case, it will be a simpler process if they decide he is the right man they go for. And I think it was interesting after the 1-1 draw with Liverpool, where Marcus Rashford, I think, had a very, very good first half, obviously scored the goal, took his chance well, got himself into good position to finish that, but I think generally was very effective at using the clever tactics that Solskjaer had implemented to take advantage of Liverpool's shape, break in between the fullback and the centre back, with Daniel James doing the same on the other side and confusing Liverpool's defence that way. I think there was an instance in which Rashford went one-on-one with Virgil van Dijk and basically bullied van Dijk off the ball and left van Dijk on the turf, which you don't see very often. So a really good performance from Rashford. But I think interesting the discussion post-match with Gary Neville sort of championing Rashford and saying, look, that's a great sign for Solskjaer, and he's showing what he has to be, and basically being shouted down by Graham Souness saying, well, you can't take one goal from after a series of blanks from a striker and decide that Rashford is the answer. And also a very pertinent comment from Jose Mourinho when he was asked what kind of striker Manchester United should go for, and his response was, if your objective is to build a team and to say all the time that the objective of the team is the future, the long term, the kids, the young players, and you hide behind that, then you don't need to buy a striker. Then play Mason Greenwood, then give Mason Greenwood time to grow up, because he is a kid with potential. And I think that gets very much to the heart of where Manchester United have set themselves up at present, with this story of it's going to take several years to fix the problems we have, and we are only going to buy players that absolutely suit our long-term plan. I think Mourinho's right there. If it is about this long-term, develop youth, etc., then why not just stick with Rashford and Greenwood? But if you want results, you clearly are going to have to sign a different kind of striker. And it'll be interesting to see the noises from Manchester United, the noises from Solskjaer, very much are they will do it in January. But it'll be interesting to see if they actually commit and how much they're prepared to commit to that purchase.
Observations on Rashford for me yesterday, Duncan, are that it's almost like Solskjaer, well, I'm sure he did watch Rashford play for England in the Euro 2020 qualifiers, where he continually made runs to the back post, almost hiding from the cross. I'd not say hiding as such, but not exactly making a huge effort to actually run across his defender, get to the front post and get to the ball first. Instead, he was very guilty of ambling and then making a late run to the back post, where, of course, the chances of meeting any cross are greatly reduced from what you would normally get. Now, what I noticed yesterday was that the goal he scored, he actually he duped Matip, because he ran across him to the front and then double backed across his left side to where he got a clear and free hit at the ball. And those for me were the instincts of an actual striker, someone who actually had thought about or instinctively knew what to do, because Matip's been in great form for Liverpool, as we know. And I think that showed him a difference in his game. I know that he made some apologies to Manchester United fans after the defeat by Newcastle. And so I thought he looked kind of reinvigorated. Certainly in the first half yesterday, I thought he played very well and fitted into what was Solskjaer's tactical plan, of course, which was to block off Liverpool's fullbacks using a back five, effectively, three in midfield and two up front. And we see Daniel James get loose for the goal cross itself. Andy Robertson finds himself isolated. Wijnaldum's not run back. And what Rashford did, as I said, in, very intelligently, was he sent Matip the wrong way. He dummied him inside, went to the back, the cross was good, and it was a simple tap-in. Now, that has to be not just encouraging, but a huge improvement in Solskjaer's, I think, both application and his ability to change his game in order to work through the problems that he's had. Because statistics tell us that he scored only 35% of his Premier League goals against the top six. That's 11 goals. And 65% against anyone outside of that, which is 20 goals.
Yeah, it's encouraging. And obviously the result is very encouraging for Solskjaer, for Manchester United. And you have to credit him for coming up with a system that that caused Jurgen Klopp big problems, and which Jurgen Klopp didn't properly resolve until the last 15 minutes of the match, when he went to 4-4-2 and gave himself and took Henderson off and gave himself two players on each wing capable of going past the Manchester United wing back, which is generally the solution you should implement when you're playing against a back five, is get two men against the wing back and exploit the weaknesses there and get the ball into the box, which is what they eventually did. The quandary for Liverpool, and I think the thing that will perplex or should perplex their supporters, is that it took Klopp so long to solve that problem. But credit to Solskjaer for coming up with a system that worked and being pragmatic about the game, setting up defensively and playing on the counter. What you have to remember is that's what suits the personality he has, and it's absolutely what suits Marcus Rashford as a striker, is to play with a system in which he is expected to counter-attack and can expect the ball in front of him with space to run onto. That's his skill. That's the best part of his game. So no surprise that he ends up being the goal scorer in that match. And again, we said in the podcast on Friday that this was perhaps the kind of game where Solskjaer could get a result, because Liverpool were obviously the stronger team, obviously better in attack. People wouldn't complain if he played pragmatically against them and got a result. His squad is built around a counter-attacking strategy that it's set up to play that way. So if you're set up to play counter-attacking football, you want the other team to come to you, which is what Liverpool did. And what you'd expect to happen. The issue for Solskjaer is, and you can say, okay, well, he's now found a system that works. If he plays that system against most of the teams in the Premier League, it won't work, because they won't come on to him and they won't attack, and he won't score enough goals, he won't win enough games. You can only play that way against a certain type of opponent. When you're Manchester United and you're expected to dominate games and win the majority of your games, you have to have multiple ways of doing that, and you have to be able to play against packed defences and find ways of breaking the opposition down that aren't just limited to we get the ball on the counter-attack and we run in quickly behind them. And that's basically how Manchester United have scored most of their goals against Premier League opposition this season, and let's face it, there haven't been many of them this season. You've got that 1-4-0 win against Chelsea, which is actually an example of the majority of the goals being counter-attacking goals against a team who were playing very open and trying to force the pace of the game. So a good Sunday for Solskjaer, but fundamentally I don't think anything has changed in terms of where Manchester United are as a team and where we would expect them to finish up over the course of the season if they continue to play this style of football.
I go back, Duncan, to the Ed Woodward mantra, which I think may well come back to haunt him in the weeks and months to come, of what Manchester United's philosophy is. And that, of course, is attacking football, playing young players and winning trophies with X-factor players as well added in, just for good measure. I think we saw Manchester United in the first half yesterday, who did dominate. I wouldn't say that it was attacking football or that it was necessarily great to watch for much of it, because a lot of it was quite scrappy. They broke up the game quite well in their own final third and then the middle third, and they pushed the ball wide to Daniel James as much as they could as well in order to get some service. It worked in terms of going a goal up, but of course the players then dropped deeper and deeper. I think as players psychologically, I think we always see that, and especially in a big game, a big derby game, we see a lot when a team is leading with a goal with 75 minutes left. Players naturally drop deeper and try to defend rather than take the ball out and try and kill the game for 2-0. Now, the game ended up a draw, but tactically, Duncan, who would you say won the battle?
I think Solskjaer, in terms of pre-game, he got it absolutely right. As I've already explained, he set his team up well. He used his forwards, his two forwards split, getting them to run between Liverpool's fullbacks and centre backs, knowing that Liverpool's attack is very much focused on pushing those fullbacks forward, and that those fullbacks deliver a lot of ball into the box from which Liverpool score goals or win set pieces and score goals from the set pieces. So it's a very, very astute plan, which we've seen Solskjaer do in the past. You know, he got a number of good results in that record-breaking run he had when he first came in as manager against teams who he might not have expected to get results against by playing similar sort of tactics. Again, the problem you have with Solskjaer is he doesn't seem to have an ability to change the course of a match in game. And I don't think it was purely a psychological element of sitting back which cost them the points there. It was once Klopp had done what was pretty much the obvious thing to do, which was put wide players alongside his fullbacks to stretch the wing backs that Manchester United were playing, to give him two players going on to each wing back down the wing, instead of what is Liverpool generally play very narrow in midfield and in attack. Their forwards come inside and their midfielders all work inside to press the opponents. And you don't see them playing a flat 4-4-2 very often, but in this particular game, that was the right solution. So you can credit Klopp for getting the tactics right in the end, but I think actually the criticism should be he took so long to come up with that solution in that match, so he doesn't come out of it particularly well. And I don't think he comes out of it particularly well from his press conference in which he complained about Manchester United playing overly defensive football and how it's always problematic for a team when you have to play against high quality players who are focused primarily on defensive duties. He's right, but I think he should just accept that he got it wrong on the day. Manchester United's players were certainly more aggressive and more motivated and more determined to get a result at the beginning of the game and therefore got an advantage in the match. He was definitely unfortunate with the VAR decision, but it's not the worst VAR decision we've seen this season. They remain in a very, very good position in the Premier League. They win their first 8 games and then they go to Old Trafford, which is a ground Jurgen Klopp has never won on, and take a point, remain with a very significant advantage over Manchester City in the Premier League title race, with Manchester City team that has a lot of problems, a lot of injury issues at present. And it remains Liverpool's title to lose.
Now, as most of us, or indeed all of us, know, Jose Mourinho began his career at Barcelona as Sir Bobby Robson's translator. And yesterday, he described Jurgen Klopp as having read the menu and expected meat but got fish. Duncan, can we ask you to be Jose's translator, please, and explain, if you can, what Jose meant by that comment?
I think it's pretty self-explanatory. You don't need, do you really need a translator for that one?
I think some of us do, yes.
He expected to go to Old Trafford and win and come away as the hero and finally get his victory over his club's greatest rivals on, in their stadium, and he didn't get what he wanted.
Oh, he didn't get what he wanted. But that is the classic. That is a proper translation. He didn't get what he wanted. Okay. And with Nashers like Jurgen, I think we know that he probably does prefer a good slice of steak to a bit of sea bass. So that's fair enough. Taking it away from just the tactical analysis, Duncan, as we said at the top of the pod, Valerie, our old friend, caused more controversy yesterday with the video assistant referee decisions, not just at Old Trafford, but at Spurs versus Watford as well. I think you were interested in comments made by former Premier League referee Mark Halsey this morning with regards to VAR and how he described the weekend's performances by those men sitting in a caravan somewhere next to Heathrow.
Yeah, look, I think we're seeing now a large number of commentators on the game stating openly what we've been stating on the podcast for well over a year, is that VAR doesn't work, and it's a problem, and it's a negative for the game. And this was, I think, this weekend of Premier League games is the second weekend of Premier League games where we've had a range of bad decisions. And errors, you know, even just simple technical errors such as putting the wrong message up on the stadium boards at Naming Rights Lane after Dele Alli's goal had been reviewed, and the decision was it wasn't a handball, and I'm not entirely sure they got that one right. I think it was questionable as to whether it caught him on the shoulder, as was claimed, or caught him on the upper part of his arm. And as we know, if it went on the upper part of his arm, then it should not have been a goal under the current laws of the game, as problematic as they are. And the current laws of the game, which cost Sadio Mane his first half goal at Old Trafford, which we haven't mentioned yet, but was, you know, another kind of ending. The focus there was on whether it was a goal or not, but it was actually a very embarrassing moment for Manchester United's defence and the way they were opened up and the mistakes that were involved in allowing Mane in for that. But you've got the Jan Vertonghen foul on Gerard Deulofeu when Watford are a goal up, which was a clear penalty kick and which VAR refused to give. And even Dermot Gallagher, the man who is paid to come on Premier League television and has spent the majority of the season defending every VAR decision to the hilt and claiming that the technology is millimetre perfect when it comes to offside, even though it's been clearly demonstrated that's not the case. Even Gallagher said that decision was wrong and the Premier League will regret it. You have the Origi foul in the build-up to Manchester United's goal. Victor Lindelof clearly fouls the player. I think Klopp's argument on why it wasn't given was correct, in the sense that you have the referee not making a decision on the field and the VARs refusing, even though they see a foul on the monitor, as everyone saw. They refused to overrule it because they've been told only to overrule clear and obvious errors. Yet you have Johnny Evans getting a foul from the VAR against Burnley in a very similar instance, because Chris Wood had, in his case, I think inadvertently clipped Johnny Evans, whereas Victor Lindelof certainly hadn't done it inadvertently. Yet that one was given as a foul. That one the VAR overrules. The one at Old Trafford they don't overrule. So there's not even consistency in application there. And it is, you know, it's been one problem after another. And I think Halsey is right in what he says, and that it is an embarrassment to the Premier League. But it's not just an embarrassment to the Premier League. It's an embarrassment to football. It's an embarrassment to FIFA. it does not improve the quality of the game. That's the bottom line.
But Duncan, if it gets more decisions right than wrong, or more decisions right than it interferes with, is that not better for the game rather than just allowing mistakes to happen and saying, oh, well, that's just what happens when you have human error?
Well, look, FIFA's argument is that if you bring in VAR, you get, 99.95% correct, or 99.35% of decisions correct in the World Cup, which was clearly untrue. If you go through that, you will see that they're basically... their biased interpretation is that everything VAR gives is correct, unless it's so blatantly, obviously incorrect that they had to admit it was wrong. Their own studies before VAR was introduced on a global basis was that it improved accuracy by around 4% over no VAR systems. Again, you can argue about how they were assessing whether the decision was correct or not, but their own claim was you get a 4% improvement, which is not very much. Therefore, if it's only that degree of improvement, and I would accept that you get more decisions correct with VAR, but the question is, what are the costs for that marginal level of increased accurate decision making? And the costs are huge. Not just the financial cost of doing it, not just the impact it has on refereeing. We've seen that this season, because the top Premier League referees have to work in the VAR studio as well. They're essentially overworked now, and we've seen a referee not turn up for a match, and a grade two referee have to be used in his place, effectively as a result of VAR. But it's the controversy, it's the delays in the decision making, it's the fact that everything is now questioned twice. We almost every game we have a discussion over whether the VAR was correct or not. The ramifications of somewhere down the line a legal challenge over a VAR decision, as you have mentioned on this podcast, because once you change what has been the long-standing way in which football has governed itself, that the referee's decision on the field is final, and you accept that the referee's decision isn't final and it's open to review, then you've removed that sort of baseline, we won't challenge referees. And then the operation of the VAR comes into question itself. And football is such a affluent game now, it is a business, that as you have predicted, I think that the legal challenge won't be too far down the line. It's just you have to weigh the benefits of a few more accurate decisions, and that's all we're getting, a few more accurate decisions, against all the costs and all the ramifications of bringing the system in. And in my view, you're better not to have the system. You're better to go back to the old way of refereeing games, because the benefits are just not justified by the costs.
I agree. I think the crux of the debate was very well summed up by United's opening goal against Liverpool. The laws of the game are very clear. If a player is fouled, and Origi was clearly fouled by Lindelof when he took a toe to the knee, inside of his knee, in the build-up. Martin Atkinson indicates that he believes there was no reason to give the free kick and waves play on. United score a goal. But because they scored a goal, the goal is automatically reviewed by VAR. So they go back to the point where the ball is taken in possession by Manchester United. At that point, either the laws of the game are the laws of the game, or they're not. That's absolutely got to be the case. A line has to be drawn, and it's clear that Origi was fouled in the build-up. But what they did was they sided with the on-field referee, again, which I'm not against, in principle, but the fact of the matter is, if they're going to apply VAR, they have to do it fully, 100%, or not. And therefore, no goal should have been given, and a foul should have been given to Liverpool for the challenge on Origi. If we went back, as you said, Duncan, to where we just accepted the rule of the referee in terms of the interpretation of what he saw at the time, then we wouldn't even have a debate. Because the fact of the matter is, the referee didn't give the foul, play went on, James crosses, and Rashford scores, goal, that's the end of it. But VAR creates its own controversy by the fact it didn't apply the laws of the game properly in not giving the foul for Lindelof on Origi in the build-up. So I think it's true to say that sometimes, in most of the cases, VAR causes more problems than it solves.
Yeah, look, you leave it to the referee and you say Atkinson got it wrong, but that's how it is. Referees get things wrong from time to time. When a guy with the benefit of slow motion replay, multiple angles, gets to see that there was a foul, as you say, there was a foul, and then decides, I can't overrule that one because it wasn't absolutely clear it was a foul. It wasn't a clear, we're only going to overrule when it's so blatantly wrong we can't do anything else. Then people say, well, what's the point? It's why have this system anyway?
Exactly,
if you're not actually going to apply it.
You're right, that is the point. The point is, if it's not going to correctly deal with the laws of the game and therefore apply the laws of the game properly as they should be, then what is the point of having it in the first place? Because these guys in the VAR decision-making unit have the opportunity to watch multiple angles and decide, okay, we must apply the laws of the game in the correct manner, and then they don't. So it's a double error. And as I said, what you do is you end up casting doubt on the actual match referee's decision, and yeah, then the controversy of having, was VAR wrong as well? And there's not a single Liverpool fan, or indeed a lot of fans throughout the country, and commentators, who would have said, well, that was the right decision by VAR not to take play back and give the foul on Origi.
Yeah, I think the Vertonghen foul on Deulofeu is a better example here.
Yes.
And that's as clear a foul as you can get. It's a clear penalty, yet VAR doesn't intervene because Premier League has set it up in such a way that a high bar, you only do it if you're absolutely clear. That one was absolutely clear. They should have intervened in that case. But all we've seen VAR give in this Premier League season is probably incorrect interpretations of the handball rule, the Laporte goal or the Laporte touch, a grazing of the arm, which that allowed the ball to fall to Gabriel Jesus for what should have been a winner against Tottenham, which nobody saw except VAR and the overruled, and these incredibly marginal offside decisions, which have been scientifically demonstrated to be impossible to accurately make. That, you know, as Mark Halsey says, it is an embarrassment, and the Premier League's got itself into this ridiculous position where they're not intervening with clear fouls, but they are intervening when for offsides that they don't actually know are offsides or not. And these, you know, this stupid new conditional version of the handball rule, and intervening when people, nobody on the pitch sees anything, nobody in the stadium sees everything, but a video operator with the benefit of slow motion and multiple angles can find a reason to chop off a goal.
Well, people, you've heard our views, and of course we love to hear your views as well. Please get in touch at transferpodcast, at Duncan Castles, at Garb West, you on Twitter. Tell us what you think of Valerie and her many flaws, and possibly some of her benefits, if that's what you think. Indeed, on all subjects we've discussed today, including Manchester United, Liverpool, the Glazers, and possible sale, as well as their pursuit of strikers in January. As this is Monday's pod, as you well know, and you're all very, very much waiting for the heroes and villains, which we promise will not include video assistant referees, I'm going to hand over to Duncan for his hero of the weekend before I give you my villain. Duncan?
Well, my hero of the week was going to be Cristiano Ronaldo for reaching 700 goals.
A worthy winner, a worthy winner.
A worthy winner would have been, but let's face it, he's going to get 750 and 800 and go past Joseph Bican as the greatest scorer of official goals in all time, and he's probably going to, as Sergio Cucinas predicted for us on our Portuguese special edition this summer, he's probably going to be the leading international goal scorer of all time before long, so we'll have another opportunity to do that. I'm going to go for Rafael van der Vaart, who has, it's been pointed out to me, has made some very interesting comments on Harry Maguire, a player who Solskjaer, I think, very cleverly protected by playing that back five at the weekend. And Maguire is much more effective when he's got two centre-backs beside him to compensate for his positional errors and his lack of pace. But Van der Vaart was asked about Maguire's price tag, and his response was, he can do something, but if he's worth so much money, Virgil van Dijk is worth £300 million. If I'm going to play with the amateurs on Sunday afternoon, I can easily find three who can do this. I mean that seriously. A bit silly to say, but I really think so. So there you go. Raphael van der Vaart, analysis of Harry Maguire. And there's another little bit in here. He said, it's funny because during the Nations League, I was doing work for Dutch television. And I remember we were saying Harry Maguire was by far the worst player on the pitch. And then 2 months later, 90 million for Harry Maguire.
Well, Raphael, we're going to try and get you on the podcast soon to just quiz you a little bit on that. But if you, in the meantime, you can just text us and let us know where you play your Sunday League football. I'd love to see that. I'd love to see the guys that are Marco van Basten hammering the ball in from the byline on the full volley. Villain for me this week. Well, he's a normal villain, but I'm going to say he's an anti-villain, actually, in this case. Our old friend Roy Keane, who thankfully has become a regular on Sky Sports as a pundit, the man who tells it as it is and pulls no punches. Just before the teams ran out at Old Trafford yesterday, he was absolutely disgusted to see several of the opposing players hugging, kissing, chatting, asking how their mums were, et cetera, and saying that's just no way to behave before a game like this. This is Manchester United, Liverpool. You have to go out there hating each other so that you get the best out of each and every one of your players. And if you want a chat, then do it after the game, or maybe not. Don't just leave that as well. I'm with Roy Keane on this one. Again, never forget Highbury Tunnel. Against Arsenal and Vieira, where he said, I'll see you out there, I'll see you out there. So my villain stroke anti-villain for this week has got to be Keeney the Great. I'm sure he'll provide us with much more entertainment as the season goes on. We hope certainly that he does. This has been Monday's Transfer Window podcast. We very much value your company, and if you like what you hear, we know thousands of you do, please, as you know, log on to iTunes, give us a 5-star review. We expand the community and the debate, and everyone is a winner, baby, that's for sure. Until Wednesday's podcast with your questions answered, and please get them in to our transferpodcast@duncancastles.garbo.sg. From now on, we'll be tooting that out today as well. We will see you through the transfer window then. Thanks for listening.